So it's good to be here and good to see, many friends. Last time I was with the Sangha, I explored the nature of awakening in traditional sense, and I want to continue with that and bring in some different material to remember that the aim of our practice is awakening. And of course, in the contemporary West, sometimes the aim of practice gets modified, or we might say diluted. And it might be that we take the aim of practice simply to relax a little bit more, or to gain some further self-knowledge. But it's helpful to continue to return to the deep aspiration to awaken and to ask what that means. And what does it mean for me personally? Do I aspire to awaken? What does it look like? That is the intention of the practice. And of course, the very name given to Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, means the awakened one. So this is at the center of the whole tradition. And yet I think that Westerners are ambivalent about awakening. And it's actually, in some ways, not taught so much, which is surprising, isn't it? That's my observation. I don't know if you share that. And the last time I was with the Sangha, I talked some about the traditional sense of awakening and looked at the meaning of awakening and the experience of awakening in three contexts: in the context of the Buddha, in the context of the lineage of the Thai forest tradition, and also in the Tibetan tradition of Dzogchen, which all of which can point to both understandings of awakening and experiences of awakening which are actually accessible. And they're accessible to each of us and in the flow of daily life. And so, actually, what I'll suggest is that moments of awakening are much more common than we believe or that we actually notice. Awakening is not hard. Stabilizing awakening and having it be our more stable and normal state, that is challenging. But we can have awakened moments, awakened insights, and it's more a matter of having that be more and more stable and be then brought into daily life, which is quite challenging. The Buddha generally, as probably most of us know, talked about awakening most commonly in a negative sense. He said that awakening is the absence, one formulation would be the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. Or we could say, more pointing to experience, the absence of habitual grasping, habitual pushing away, and confusion or ignorance of, multiple kinds. And that was his more common way of pointing to awakening. It was to emphasize what we work through. And so all the times when we are mindful of grasping and pushing away, what I call collectively reactivity, we are working with what stands in the way of awakening. We are transforming what stands in the way of awakening. And what I'm going to, be doing this evening, somewhat briefly, is to try to bring the awakening process into being accessible in our daily practice and in our daily lives. And in fact, invite us in the next week leading up to, for some of us, being in person next week, to suggest some ways of practicing in the next week that we can then bring to our time together next week. That's what I'll come back to as I explore the territory.
Very good. Okay, well, I'm going to remove.
From the Dhammapada. Those who fully cultivate the factors of awakening, give up grasping, enjoy non-clinging, have destroyed the toxins. They are luminous and completely liberated in this life. And I'll come back and look at this model of the seven factors of awakening as a very accessible and practical way to really track our own awakening process. And there are other models like this. There's a more extensive model, which at least some of you know, called the Bodhipakya Dhamma, which means the qualities or dhammas which lead to awakening, bodhi. Bodhi is the term for awakening. And this is a more extensive model, sometimes called the seven sets or the 37 wings of awakening, that the Buddha gave for his sort of comprehensive listing of the most important teachings he had given. And so in that set, which I once studied and practiced for 2 years, the seven sets, it includes the seven factors of awakening, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four noble truths, the four ways of skillful effort, the five spiritual faculties, and I think the Eightfold Path is there. Yeah, the Noble Eightfold Path. And the a more obscure teaching called the four bases of power, which is hardly taught at all. And for me, it was actually part of my training. I was in a group with several other teachers, and we studied these for about 2 to 3 years. And my assignment was to study each of the seven and give talks on them. And then actually Gil Fronsdale was mentoring me on my talks at that time. This was like 20 years ago. And he would give me feedback on my talks on these seven sets. So mostly the teaching is about awakening is more negative, that which we give up, that which we transform. As I mentioned the last time I was here, there are some more positive notions of what an awakened state is that we find with the Buddha, with the Thai forest tradition, with some of the Tibetan traditions. And that notion of an awakened state was described by the Buddha, that this quality is what he called signless, boundless, and luminous. That there is a quality of the mind which I and others often call awakened awareness, which is beyond all conceptual use, really, beyond all conceptualization. That's the signless part. It's also boundless. It becomes vast and extensive, and the boundary between inner and outer is no longer there. It's sort of a vast, non-dual, luminous awareness. And the Buddha talked about that. You know, he talked about this somewhat on the margins of the teaching. This teaching doesn't come into the core teachings like the Four Noble Truths, but it's on the margins. Here's one passage. When consciousness is signless, boundless, and all luminous, that's where earth, water, fire, and air find no footing. They're both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, name and form are holy. So there's a quality, there's a more positive characterization. We find something similar in the Thai forest tradition. Some of the teachers there talk about the radiant mind, and they say it's beyond ordinary experience. It's a non-ordinary quality of our being, which we can access. And some of the training was being in touch with that radiant mind. Achan Cha, the teacher of Jack Kornfield and someone whom I studied with briefly, he talked about it as the old mind or the original mind. He said, this original mind is unconditioned. There is no good or bad or long or short or black and white. It sounds like the Buddha, right? The nature of the original mind is unwavering. It is tranquil. Practice means searching to find our way back to our original state. He calls it the old thing. It's our old nature. Finding our old home, the original mind that does not waver and change following phenomena. It's by nature perfectly peaceful. It's already within us. So there's a pointing to a quality of our being which we can access. And I think I'll come back to that, in a future session. You also find something very similar in Tibetan tradition, where there's something like what we could call awakened awareness, a non-dual awareness that is vast, in which there's not a separation of self and other. And we sometimes experience this in the wilds or at certain moments in our lives. We can experience this naturally without outside even of meditation. You know, and how many people have had a taste of something like that, either in meditation or outside of meditation? So it's accessible. And the pointer in these teachings is to learn to access this awakened awareness and then have it become more and more stable, first in meditation and then in daily life. So one of the ways that we cultivate this, there are different ways to cultivate such awakening. The way I'll focus on now, and I'll focus on the accessing of awakened awareness in a future teaching, but one way to develop awakening is to further certain qualities. And this is the teaching of the seven factors of awakening, which probably many of us are pretty familiar with. These are seven factors which, when we cultivate them, move us towards awakening. They're also expressions of the awakened mind, body, and heart. And many of you know these qualities. There are seven of them, and they're organized into three groups. One is the first, which is mindfulness, which is taken to be a balancing factor and is always valuable. And then there are two other groups. One is a group of three, which are sort of energizing factors. These include inquiry and energy and sort of bliss or pleasure, what's called piti. Some of you know that in other contexts. Those energize our practice. So an awakened person has energy, right? And then there are three more stabilizing qualities, which are tranquility, concentration or samadhi, and then equanimity. And it's an interesting teaching because it says that the second set, the energizing factors, are not always helpful. We use these when we need energy. If we're restless, let's say, there's a lot of thinking going on, we don't focus on the energizing factors. We focus on the stabilizing factors. Similarly, there are times when the stabilizing factors are not so helpful and we don't focus there. For example, if the mind is very dull, or if there's not much interest or much energy in the body, then we would focus on the second set. So already the model is inviting us to ask, what is appropriate right now, given how my mind, heart, and body are? So this is from the Buddha. When the mind becomes sluggish, it is untimely to develop tranquility. The enlightenment factor of concentration, or the enlightenment factor of equanimity. Because the mind is sluggish, it is difficult to arouse it with these things. It's like throwing wet grass, wet cow dung, and wet timber on fire, spraying it with water and soil onto a small fire to make it flare up. And he says, similarly, it's untimely to develop inquiry and so forth when the mind is overly active, or he says, when the mind becomes excited. And these are taken to be core ways of working through any obstructions to awareness. Anytime we get caught in reactivity, or you can see low energy to overly high energy, or even doubt, we cultivate these qualities. So I'll go through these, and my invitation will be to have each of us ask, which of these factors would I like to focus on in the next week? And maybe one or two of them, not all seven. Which would I like to focus on? And a lot of these will be familiar, so I'll be brief, particularly on mindfulness. So mindfulness is the balancing factor. It's the factor of really of clear seeing, noticing what's there, and knowing that we're noticing, knowing that we're noting. It's probably the Buddha's most distinctive teaching that wasn't there with the yogic teachings and practices that he learned from his teachers. It was an innovation to bring in mindfulness. You know, he says that mindfulness, you may remember from the sutta on the foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness is the direct path for the purification of beings. In other words, mindfulness is probably the most central quality that the Buddha recommends to move towards awakening. You know, when mindfulness and the tradition went to China, the pictogram that they formed for mindfulness, the character, had three aspects or three symbols joined together. One was present moment, another was heart, and another was home. So mindfulness is finding a home for the heart, we might say the heart-mind, in the present moment. So we're not lost. So again, very, very central. And we learn how to cultivate mindfulness, you know, through being mindful of the body, through being in the foundations of mindfulness, being mindful, especially of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Very, very key to studying reactivity, as I think we most of us have explored. That's the second foundation, which isn't taught as often. That could be a real key. Notice when the mind has a high degree of pleasant or a high degree of unpleasant, and track it for reactivity, track it for grasping and pushing away. When there's a strong element of pleasant or unpleasant, can be a very, very helpful practice. And then just noticing the thoughts and emotions and body states. So mindfulness is the ability to be attentive to experience, to be more directly with experience without interpreting. Again, this is very familiar for many of us. There's a kind of openness to mindfulness. Mindfulness can be with whatever comes up. You know, we don't pick or choose with mindfulness. So it has a quality of openness that can really, when we sit, can invite things to come to the surface that come from our more unconscious territories. So there's a quality of opening even beneath the surface with mindfulness. A very key aspect is that mindfulness is non-reactive. Mindfulness can be present with what's there without trying to change it, without being reactive. So we often say that Mindfulness of anger is not angry. Mindfulness of reactivity is not reactive. It has this quality of being able to be present to our own confusion. Quite something, isn't it? I mean, really, think of it. We have a way of bringing awareness to our own lack of awakening. And in that moment, we're awake. Eventually, mindfulness done over and over again leads to insight and wisdom. You know, we keep on looking and we see things. We see our habits, we see our patterns. We notice larger patterns. We develop intuition and so forth. And maybe the last thing to say, which is not always emphasized, is that I think mindfulness in its mature form involves a quality of care. And that's something we can check on. Does my mindfulness have a quality of metta or care? Is it more, you know, is it a little more cold? Does it have warmth? You know, so I think of mindfulness having warmth in the way that when I listen to a friend, there's warmth there, there's empathy or compassion. So that's a more advanced way to check our mindfulness. Can I really, you know, as Sylvia Boorstein says, meet this moment fully and meet this moment as a friend. That's from Sylvia. So the second through the seventh qualities will probably be much less familiar for some of us, at least. The second is inquiry. Again, these are activating. This is an activating quality. Inquiry, and again, I'm inviting everyone to say, which of these would I like to bring more in? Inquiry is looking more deeply, looking and discerning what's there. Sometimes it's asking questions. It might be to ask, you know, when I notice myself repeating a story over and over again, what's beneath the story, or what's there in my body right now? When I bring my attention to my body, what's there? So inquiry can use questions. It can involve directing the mind. It's not as, you know, it's not as open in some ways in some forms of mindfulness where we just have a kind of open awareness and let whatever occurs occur. And with inquiry, we use wisdom and discernment to really bring attention to what might be there. You know, we ask what's happening in the body, or I'm having this emotion occurring, what's it like? Or when my anger, let me be with my anger. And when my anger stops, what other emotion is there? So we notice changes. We can inquire into how things move. We can see what's beneath the surface. We can, in many ways, look more deeply. It might be just to stay with a repetitive thought and keep on noticing how it changes. What's it like in the emotions and body? It could involve going back and forth between a story and what's there in the body, and really, really looking more deeply. It might be to use a teaching. You know, inquiry might be to say, you know, this is like one of the first instructions I ever got. Joseph Goldstein was my first teacher. And early on, probably just almost right at the beginning of my practice, he gave me really an inquiry practice. He said, if there's suffering, where's the attachment? So this would be working with a teaching, right? You know, the core teaching is that grasping and pushing away, or particularly in the teaching he was giving me, the grasping, that leads to dukkha. That leads to a sense of suffering. So I could start with noticing that there's some anguish or some struggle, and then I could ask the question, is there some kind of grasping or pushing away here? Can I feel that? that's working with a teaching, or it could be to work with a teaching. I'm noticing the reactivity of grasping or pushing away. Can I touch the pleasant sense that's connected with the grasping? Could be pleasant in the body, pleasant in one's mind. Can I touch that? Because it's in some way the reactivity, according to the teaching on dependent origination, is driven by grasping onto the pleasant or pushing away the unpleasant. Can I actually, in the moment, touch what's driving my reactivity? Inquiry could do that for us. So inquiry can work with a teaching. It can work. There's a lot more we could say about this. You know, it's actually, I think, a relatively undeveloped quality for many of us, and it can be quite powerful just to see what's there, and sort of there are ways of unraveling our reactivity by inquiry and understanding better and seeing more clearly. Inquiry is particularly really appropriate when we're experiencing something, particularly a form of reactivity or even some emotion, some story that lasts for a while. We don't use inquiry so much when things are just coming and going quickly. We could use inquiry to track impermanence, something like that. We could do it, but we especially use the kinds that I've mentioned so far when there is something lasts for a while, like I'm angry for 10 minutes. Excellent candidate for inquiry. Okay. Or, you know, I have unpleasant sensations in my body and it lasts for 5 minutes and it's not causing damage and I can hang out with it. A great way to inquire. How do I not like the unpleasant? How do I want to resist that? So wonderful, wonderful way of practicing. The third factor is energy, virya, sometimes translated as resolve. And this is to say again that awakened people have energy. And so this can be energy in the body. It can be, which can sometimes be blissful. Sometimes there's just a lot of ways that we have our meditative energy get stronger. We can work with developing the energy in the body, maybe by, you know, if we notice the energy is a little bit flat or stuck, we could do something like Qigong and we'll likely do a little bit of Qigong next week, you know, when we're in person. We can do Qigong, we can take an active walk. The energy level has to be there, really, for our practice to prosper. And, you know, the Buddha connected, a good level of energy often with more external behavior, with moderation in eating, with regular practice, with hearing talks, reading texts. This really can arouse energy, being inspired, you know. So to ask oneself, what helps me have energy for practice? That would be working with this third factor. What helps me have energy for practice? What really strengthens? What lets me practice more with more vigor, with more interest? You know, and traditionally there are all sorts of ways that developing faith had a very key role for energy. You know, in one of the lists of the Buddha, he lists like 10 or 15 different ways to arouse energy. You know, remembering the greatness of the Buddha, remembering one's own teachers, avoiding lazy people, except if they're relatives. No, the Buddha didn't add the last part. But that was actually on his list, you know, like, do you have company with people who are energetic? Mm-hmm. The fourth quality is piti, could be translated as joy or bliss or rapture. Again, this is energizing. Again, this can come from, many of you know, from developing samadhi there and our practice generally, there can be the piti or a certain quality of bliss and pleasure develops in the body, which is taken to be a sign of awakening. You know, that the, that there, that that pleasure or bliss is there. And it can open up when the mind is quiet and still. It can be something which really leads to sort of a excitement about practice. I know when I was first doing my first retreat, the whole area of the subtle energy of the body opened up. And I didn't really know much about it. I said, whoa, this is amazing. And it also tended to quiet the mind. PT doesn't always do that, but often it does, that the quality of pleasure and bliss can lead to tremendous levels of contentment, happiness, really being eager to practice, you know, and feeling a kind of excitement. The main cause of such joy and bliss is the mind becoming quiet through mindfulness and careful attention. One can also have this quality of joy again come from hearing the teachings, being with good friends. Again, in the traditional teachings, there was a long list of different supports for the quality of joy. Even acting generously, reflecting on the importance of ethical virtue and so forth. There then, I'll finish with this, then there are three more stabilizing factors. Tranquility, and I could, you know, each of these could be the topic of a whole talk. So I'm being a little briefer than I could be. So there's tranquility or calmness, and this is more a tranquility of mind and a calmness of mind that can be a very beautiful quality. That it's thought that actually a joyful mind, heart, and body leads to a tranquil body. There's a lack of restlessness. There's a way that the mind and body and heart are simply calm and very present. Not much going through. You know, the impediments to awareness are not there. There's a very simple, really contented awareness. And again, the main way to develop all of these, actually the first that's listed when there's a guide to how we develop these, is careful attention and mindfulness. All of these develop through that, but there are other ways as well. You know, and the Buddha does talk about having not too much, not too little food, having the proper food. Posture is important. Being around other people who are calm was mentioned. You know, and this is like some of you remember that Achan Cha passage where he talks about one's mind becoming like a still forest pool, you know, which is calm. And there can be ripples or things happen, but things don't get too worked up. And this is one of the qualities of awakening. Samadhi, the sixth quality, is, you know, different than calm. A calm mind is not necessarily very concentrated, but samadhi, or the sixth factor, I prefer to use the original language because concentration in English sometimes means trying very hard and, you know, a little bit of tension. So samadhi is literally, in the language, it's the gathering together of one's own mind and being, or the kind of the unification of the mind, heart, and body. And typically we do this by focusing on one object like the breath or something else, and the mind coming to stillness, and the awakened mind, when we go to those qualities that I mentioned in the beginning from the Buddha of being signless, boundless, and all luminous. This is a deeply concentrated mind, actually, where the concentration or the samadhi is now natural without any effort. That the awakened state is like that. And, the quality of being signless means that the samadhi has worked through all conceptualization. And when the mind is quite developed in samadhi, there can be just in an instant a moving to the stillness of the mind and the lack of conceptualization. That's the further horizon that's possible. And then lastly, I'll finish with equanimity is the balanced mind that can be with everything without reactivity and see clearly. That's a quick way to talk about it. The quality of balance with whatever comes up. A lot of it comes from experience. If I've been with all the things which can upset me, and I know them, and I know fear, I know anger, I know reactivity, when I know those well, they don't scare me. And I just say, oh, there's reactivity. Here's a skillful way to work with it. Easier said than done, right? But I know fear. Fear doesn't scare me. Or I've worked with so this is the fruit of practice. Equanimity is the fruit. It's not something we have in the beginning. But after a while, when we remember to practice, even something that's difficult comes up. As when we come back to practice, equanimity will more likely be there. So what quality of out of all of these seven would I like to work with in the next week? What one or two would I like to focus on? How might I work with it in formal meditation? How might I work with each of these in the flow of daily life? So let me finish with that and invite us to take a moment, maybe a minute or so. Which of these seven qualities, maybe one or two, would I like to focus on in the next week? How can I develop these more in both my formal practice and in daily life? We could actually, in our discussion, if we wish, focus on that. Thank you. So again, this is a traditional, very traditional way of coming to awakening by developing these factors. And I'm inviting us to do that in our own way for the next week. So let's open things up. And I think I can't see everyone, but I can see most people. I see Liz has something to ask. And Bill, can you help me? So you can either do the raised hand function or just raise your hand physically. And Bill, could you help to track? Yeah. So I have Liz and then Mary Page. Okay, please, Liz.
Hi there. Is patience a factor of awakening? I don't remember where and if that fits anywhere.
Which what was your question?
Patience? Patience.
Patience?
Yes.
Patience is on the list of the paramis.
A patience is a parami.
Yeah. But patience is not a factor of awakening, but I think that people who awaken are patient.
I'm finding it an extremely important quality that I need to support.
really, really, really crucial. Again, I think to some extent, I would say maybe in relation to what you're asking, Liz, is that to some extent, maybe these seven factors could be augmented. It might be a little arbitrary to limit it to seven. I think that's true of some of the Buddhist teachings, that we could actually have a longer list. We could merge the 10 paramis and the seven factors of awakening. But it's not in the actual list, though, but it's in the list of the paramis, to the best of
the our paramis. Memory. So what would you say, how are the paramis different from the seven factors of awakening?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It's just a different list.
It's different. I think that the paramis do involve more relational dimensions of practice. You know, that they're often in relation to others. So it involves metta, it involves the being ethical, and so forth. And so the seven factors, it's a great question. I haven't thought it out carefully. My first response would be that these seven factors are a little more focused on the meditative dimensions of practice. And the paramis, like generosity and so forth, are more on the relational and ethical dimensions of practice, a little bit more. Paramis include samadhi and metta, but that would be my first take on it.
Thank you. Patience has become a very important quality for me to work on.
It's great. Yeah, so you can add it as your honorary eighth factor of awakening.
Thank you so much.
You have my permission.
I am grateful.
Okay. Mary, please.
How does Nibbana or like stream entry relate to this?
How do Nibbana and stream entry relate to this? To awakening. Yeah, it's not utterly clear. A lot, like I say, the Buddha didn't talk very much about awakening, you know, and my sense of why was that he wanted to avoid people getting into metaphysical discussions. And there probably also was some caution about describing very much the more advanced stages of practice. And so that'd be my guess, but at least some people will say that the kind of experience of awakening that I mentioned, the Buddha pointing to signless, boundless, all luminous, that is touching Nibbana, and that some people would maintain that. I don't think there's consensus about that, but some would maintain that is actually touching what the Buddha was referring to by Nibbana, and that one's first significant glimpse of that is stream entry. Some would say that. Yeah. Personally, I don't work so much with those concepts in my teaching or my own practice, but that is plausible if we bring all this together. Yeah. Thanks, Mary. Please, Jan. And then Bowman.
I'd like to use inquiry, but I think it's a tendency of me to be in my head.
Yeah.
Do you have advice for?
That's a wonderful question. How do you use inquiry, knowing that one sometimes can be intellectual or have strong tendencies to like to think things out? So really crucial question. And it fills in some where I didn't go into depth. I think in my practice suggestion would be to use inquiry only when the mind is fairly quiet.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I said that too strongly. But to be careful if the inquiry is just leading you to think more. That it's really about using the mind somewhat minimally to point, to look at part of our experience. So the important point of inquiry is looking carefully at experience and less the thinking. The thinking, you know, like saying, let me feel this in the body. That would be a kind of inquiry. The emphasis isn't on the words, let me think, let me look at the body. It's on the experiential touching of a certain area. So think of inquiry as sort of pointing the attention towards part of experience, or to look in a certain way, sometimes using a particular framework. Like, you know, if I'm, you know, like in that instruction I had from Joseph Goldstein, if I'm suffering, where's the attachment, right? So it'd be actually to ask that question and then sit back and look, can I feel some attachment, rather than thinking about it. So it's kind of a thin line between that, right, Jan? But it's, yeah. It's to, I would say, to do it when the mind is fairly quiet. If you're thinking a lot, inquiry wouldn't be so helpful. Although, if you're thinking a lot, sometimes you could, particularly if you're repeating the same thing, inquiry could say, let me feel this in the body. That would be valuable. But it's to, I think, almost, Jan, by asking that question, you're setting up a safeguard. You know what I mean? Because we're wanting to make sure that the inquiry doesn't just become a lot of thinking about it. Okay? How does that sound?
Give it a try.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Bowman and then Isabel.
Yeah, thanks, Donald. So similar to Jen's question, I can see that maybe samadhi and inquiry as some of these factors can lead to more mindfulness. Am I on the right track there?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, different for the different things. In a way, this is going back really to something that we don't always recognize about mindfulness, particularly when we look to the teaching of the four foundations, partly because we practice a lot where we just say, let me be mindful. And we have a kind of, then we just see, okay, what's predominant? I'll be mindful there. When you look to the actual instructions on mindfulness, it's saying, be mindful here. Be mindful of the body. Be mindful of the feeling tone. Be mindful of thoughts. Be mindful of emotions. It's actually saying, focus here. And inquiry is doing something similar. It's like in the example I gave, it's saying, be mindful to the body, like maybe when there's a lot of thinking going on. It's saying, look here. Again, in relation to what Jan was saying, it's really about sort of directing us to look in a certain way, directing us to be mindful in a certain way. Samadhi is a little different. Samadhi, we cultivate samadhi, but for the purposes of then having a really stable mind so we can set up mindfulness. Right. And so sometimes we might, when we're really distracted, we might develop samadhi and then look in a certain way or look at a certain thing. But generally, samadhi is more the preparation for mindfulness. You know, and, you know, when we have good samadhi, we're actually have a very stable mind, and then we can look more carefully without so much thinking coming in.
I see. Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bowman. Isabel, please.
Yeah, hi, Donald.
Hi.
So in another group I belong to, we're studying the seven factors. Oh, every wow. week we study a specific, it's like one of my favorite teachings, all-time teaching.
Yeah.
And so I had some, I mean, I actually love Jan's question because I am the same way, as I'm always in my head. Yeah. And one of the things I found helpful was that the way we read about it, it says to clearly see the details of the present moment.
Yeah.
And for me, that really helped to not to try to just be in this moment and not think about other things. And that really helped me a lot. Great. And then the other thing I was going to mention was that I love the way the teaching that we're reading says it's called, they culminate.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that's true. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Say that again about culminating.
That like they culminate, like the stronger your mindfulness is, the more you're able to investigate, and the more you investigate, the more energy you get from it and so forth.
Yeah, they're in the something I didn't bring out in the teaching, but maybe on your first point, I think it helps us to remember that the point of inquiry is the looking. That the inquiry is saying, almost like saying, look here, or let's focus here.
Yeah.
And so it's the words help us to look in a certain place. Look at the box, there's a lot of anger and I'm caught up in my story. Let's look at what's there in the body. And then it's really just the looking, the mindfulness.
Yeah, I love the way you talked about that earlier too, that it really takes the charge out of it once you're mindful with it. Then it takes the charge out of it to just say, I'm angry. And laugh about it or whatever, or I feel, whatever it is.
To that one, because it's the repetition of the storyline which keeps the anger. And when we actually move the attention to the body and then, very important with anger is also to watch what happens when anger ends, because it will often go to another emotion like sadness, for example.
When I was angry earlier today, I remembered the teaching about the honey soaked arrow, because it was like, I just wanted to keep angrier and angrier. And it's like, no, you don't do that. Just don't do that. It's like, it's so much easier when you are mindful of it. I think that was the only two questions I really had, but I love the teaching. And I think, that's what I was going to say was that, it's the second arrow that these teachings help me reduce the amount of time I spend on second arrows, because you have to be right there on top of, especially investigation, because you can't, you're not really allowed to go somewhere else. You have to stay right there in the present moment. So it's really a lot easier to say, I'm not going to jump on that.
Yeah. And we could, this is a way of practicing in daily life, or let's say I know I'm going into a difficult conversation with work or family, and I can say, this is almost like an inquiry ahead of time. Let me have my radar looking out for the second arrow.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Okay,
so
thank you so much.
Let me have my radar looking out for reactivity. That would be a great way to bring this into the daily flow. And the other point you made that I didn't go into too much was that in the teachings, there is the sense that one leads to another.
Yeah.
The more mindfulness is, the better we're able to inquire. Inquiry can give energy. The more energy there is, the more joy. The more joy there is, the more contentment and tranquility. The more calm and tranquil we are, the easier concentration is. The more stability there is, the easier equanimity is. So there is that teaching. I don't know if it's, real causal in some absolute way, but there is a connection between all of these.
Yeah, I think what I love most is looking for them in my daily life and realizing how far I am on the path, because I can see, I can pull out moments where I've had any one of them and it's like, wow, yeah, this is great.
That's great. Yeah, I think maybe I'll close with this and we'll move towards our meta cards and so forth. But I think it's very helpful just to, one of the things you can do, I think you're pointing to this as well, is that with this practice, we can, this would be a skillful way to practice, would be, two or three times a day, taking an inventory of which of these factors are there and which are not there.
Yeah.
Maybe in a quiet time, I'm going into a meeting. Which of my factors of awakening are there?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Love it. Love it. Thank you so much, Donald.
You're welcome. And then, which might I strengthen? So, which might I strengthen? So, let me just finish again by inviting us to set an intention for the next week. How many of you would like to work with the factors of awakening preparing for next week? Okay. And so just ask yourself, what's a good way for me to practice? Do I want to focus on one or two of these? You know, we should have the talk up pretty soon. Take a minute. How do I want to practice in the next week?